accession number 23818, Reel 12.
Commander Easton, Reel 12. We're talking about your time as executive officer aboard HMS London in the 1960s. What about the guided missiles you had aboard? Were you much aware of the weapon system and what she was carrying?
Well, yes, the principal weapons were the sea slug, which were, in those days, the Navy's principal ship-to-air weapon. They were stowed in an enormous magazine throughout about two-thirds of the length of the ship, a half anyhow, of the length of the ship, stowed horizontally on a complex or railway system, which delivered the weapons to the launcher through ports at the after end. I think the launcher carried two, I'm not quite sure about that. But inside, this will be, I don't know, about 50 of these sea slugs. Very vulnerable. I was always worried that they were so vulnerable.
In what way were they vulnerable, sorry?
Because they were well above, they're not sitting there in this big magazine, only, you know, fairly thin steel plating between them and the outside world, and any kind of impact of an explosive device would have caused catastrophic damage. It was a design that was not followed up. Later ones, weapons were stowed vertically in a much more compact way.
Any other weaponry?
The Sea Cat close range guided missile. That was really was for self defence, or entirely self defence.
Was there storage? Where was there storage?
They had more or less conventional magazines down in the ship, because the Sea Cat missile is only about this long, about 5 feet long or so. During our time on the South Coast, we'd done practice firings of all these weapons. So the ship was fully operational. Having visited Rio de Janeiro, we went across the Atlantic and called in at anchored off Tristan da Cunha, which one always likes to make a visit to, being so isolated. Pleasant little community, very self-contained, very unsurprised at being visited by a ship. The phlegmatic might be the word. The ship was then due to visit the Far East, and calling it at Simonstown in South Africa, then going on east to Singapore. By Simonstown, I come to the end of my time. I've been in this appointment for about two and a half years, and I left.
So I was sort of 1963 to...
Yes, 63. Yes, I think I was probably went up to Newcastle.
In 62.
Maybe end of 62. All 63 in the London until 1965, when I was appointed as Queen's Army Master Portland.
And that was to be your last posting?
It was. I did an exceptionally long period of 12 years there. It was almost unheard of in naval circles. I think the...
And this was Queen's Harbour Master at Portland?
Portland, yes.
And from
1965 to 76. End of 76.
And what was the role, firstly, of Queen's Harbour Master?
It's a statutory job, actually. It's appointed by the Privy Council, and the organisation behind it is that every port, every harbour in the country, be it military or civilian, has a harbour master, it is a statutory appointment. Naval ones are called Queen's Harbour Masters. So your scope of your duties is laid down in a document issued by the Privy Council. One is, of course, responsible to the local naval admiral, but as far as civilians are concerned, one is definitely a sort of a local legal figure with powers over them, which are taken direct. Doesn't go through naval lines.
But powers over what? Can you just extend?
Everything that goes on in the harbour. Movements of ships, fishing, mooring ships, berths. The harbour master is the harbour authority. And as the QHM Portland, I was responsible to the flag officer sea training, who is the admiral at Portland. And then through him to CNC Portsmouth. But as far as any civilian using the harbour is concerned, the harbour master, whether he be a humble harbour master at Memphis or the Queen's harbour master at a big naval port, is the authority.
And where are you living?
Living in a naval house above the harbour, with weird and draconian powers, in fact, which date back to a long time, and powers over ships' masters, some of which obviously stem from sailing ship times. You order a master to strike his topmast or do anything like with him. He's just got to obey.
And what was your sort of daily routine?
Well, I was Queen's Harbour Master and Commander of the Base was the title of the job. So the base, naval base as such, with its 300-odd civilian employees, ranging from row sweepers through crane drivers, and tugs crews, riggers, moorings men, all that kind of thing. In my world, I had an assistant Queen's Harbour Master and a bosun, and a senior team of what's now called Royal Maritime Auxiliary Service personnel, civilians, tug masters, basically to help one. Fleet of tugs and all the necessary support vessels to run a port with. And one was responsible for the berthing of ships, the allocation of berths, the movements of ships, tug assistance when required, as a part of the naval workup staff there. I had to also sort of instruct and advise incoming ships, particularly sort of first-time commanding officers, on aspects of berthing and unberthing and using tugs, and watch them as they go about their business. Tidiness, cleanliness of the base, the naval club there, any job connected with the establishment of the base was broadly mine.
And what sort of problems do you remember having or overcoming?
I was unfortunate in having the tip of the top of the industrial unrest, which was going on in the late 60s. Among the tug personnel and others, all to do with overtime, bargaining for overtime, and it was happening in all the ports, and militant trade unionism, you might call it, which of course, naturally enough, was quite new to me, but had to chair the what was called the Whitley Committee, which is the trade union committee. As individuals, they couldn't have been less unpleasant, but they had to go through the motions. I think of all the ports, we were probably the least militant, possibly because we were the busiest. But I never liked it. Threats of overtime bans. Once or twice overtime bans. They never succeeded in actually stopping the port. We had ways of doing everything we needed to.
Any other problems you encountered?
No, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a...
What did you enjoy about it? I mean, what was so good about the posting?
To have such a gigantic harbour to look after, one of the biggest artificial harbours in the world, a lot going on, very, very busy, with ships coming and going all the time, particularly foreign warships, because we worked up a great number of foreign warships as well as our own. Being in a sort of crack RN team of the working up officers and chief petty officers who are going out and actually instructing the ships. They were creme de la creme, being part of that team. Being concerned with the fishermen, the sailing. Supervising the development of the port as a port, which means the installation of new craneage when required, installation of new jetties when required, dredging, all that kind of thing. As often as not, one had to conceive the need first and then see that it was done. It's a big job and well worth doing. And I think I've left alone for 12 years because being such a busy place navally, the Admiral and his staff didn't really have time for this kind of thing. Or perhaps the inclination, quite honestly, they're too busy elsewhere, so they wanted stability. And by letting me alone there, they had stability. When a new admiral or captain of the base came, they had somebody there who'd seen it all before. I think that puts it in essence.
I mean, it did mean that your own naval career was in a way sort of in a dead end. But did you not see it as a dead end?
I knew it. I think that when I quite soon after I arrived there after a year or two, I had gone over the top, passed over.
What do you mean? Sorry.
Oh, the promotion zone. The promotion is zoned, and when you reach X years as a commander, you're no longer eligible, passed over. Then you go on to promotion age. And you're a soldier on in the same rank. It's a system which one can never get right, get absolutely right, all sorts of anomalies. But I was quite content, and I think having an absolutely first-class job like this didn't worry me. And I went on to the age of retired at the statutory age of 53.
So you had no choice about your retirement?
No, no.
What about your post-service career? Because it must have... I mean, you've been in the Navy all your life.
Yes. Yeah, I had from the age of 13, naval cadet, yes. Well, very difficult as a seaman, non-specialist, to find any decent job immediately. So... I sculled about for about a year. Was living here then. First job I got was the offer from the editor of a glossy Navy defence magazine. To assist him, so assistant editor, which was quite fun, putting a magazine together. I had to receive the articles, receive the photographs, and put them all together, make a decent-looking magazine. That was fun, but it was quite clear that what they really wanted was a chap to take over as editor in due course. It wasn't my cup of tea. You've got to be a very... very sort of hail fellow, well met, clubby, finger in every pie kind of chap to do that. It didn't suit my experience at all. So I slipped quietly out from under that after a year or so, and dabbled in charity work. King George's Fund of the Sailors, one of the area officers, didn't like that at all. Hated travelling every day to people's houses, trying to persuade various worthies to surrender their, to open their purses. Again, not me at all. Then... I got the job I really wanted all the time with the hydrographer of the Navy. I really knew it was my field. Sort of natural background to navigation, of book writing. One of the hydrographer's revisers being a team of about 12, mostly retired commanders like me. One or two retired Merchant Navy captains who were working at home with information provided from the hydrographic headquarters, constantly revising and rewriting navigational publications, which I did at home, and that was absolutely splendid. And 8 years doing that took me up to 65 years of age, and I thought, well, that's, I'll retire.
And that was the
hydrographer of the Navy. You see, in those days, based at Taunton, an admiral, hydrographic branch being part of the Navy and uniformed like the Navy, but doing their own trade all the time. Once a hydrographer, always a hydrographer. It's a specialised subject, intensely specialised.
And that kept you to retirement?
That kept me to retirement age. I retired at 65, yes.
Now, just finally, you've kept some links with your old shipmates. Certainly, you're a member of the Captain Class Association. I think of the HMS Calder.
Calder, yes.
Any others? And why are they important to you?
Well, Calder... I think because it was war years. Most of the ship's company, it was the only ship they ever served in, their first and last ship. So they were a very tight knit lot, and when it was suggested that we should start having reunions about 8 years ago, we managed to contact quite a large number of them. Have a leading light in the way of ex-able seaman Fine, Harry Fine, who's made it his life interest to run these reunions. And it just took off splendidly. The three of us officers remaining, the Jim Davidson, the executive officer of the Calder, me, the navigator. Until recently, there was one more. He has now dropped out. But we two, Harry Fine, doing practically all the work and doing it very well indeed. And we meet again in October, in fact.
Is it important to you now? I mean...
I've never been a sort of hanging on to the coattails of the Navy since retirement. But I do support this wholeheartedly, yes. It's individuals are obviously so keen on it. They won't let us stop. We Harry and I think perhaps this might be the last year, but it's not going to be. They say, no, we want to go on while there's breath in us, we'll go on. So we've got to go on.
It's up to you how you answer, but how do you feel about, I mean, you were an officer, you know, and yes. You were a regular officer.
Yes.
How does it feel strange now mixing with the other ranks, so to speak?
Not in the least. No, it's very gratifying just to see how well... And not being patronising, but how very well many of them have done. None of them who we've met have done badly. Many of them have done extraordinarily well. We're all very happy, all on Christian name terms, but they've got enough tradition in them to realise that they do obviously sort of defer to Jimmy Davidson and I, but it's not on the sort of social kind of level at all. They're glad to have us around to sort of run things, and I think they're glad there's at least a couple of officers left.
Thank you very much.